This program is brought to you by Chefs Collaborative, a nonprofit with a mission to inspire, educate, and celebrate chefs and food professionals building a better food system. Change menus, change lives. Learn more at chefscollaborative.org.
Thank you for listening to Heritage Radio Network. We are a member-supported nonprofit food radio station. That means that every single thing we do, from broadcasting 35 weekly shows for free to bringing you exclusive content from sold-out food events across the country to offering scholarships to high school students, is only possible thanks to the support of our loyal members. And we want you to join the club. Become a member during our 2017 summer drive to get access to sweet swag and pledge your support to the world's only food radio station. Visit heritageradionetwork.org/donate to become a member now.
From Heritage Radio, it's Why Food, a show about creators, entrepreneurs, and visionaries in the food industry and the stories behind their success. And this week, I'm here with Jordan Silbert from Q Drinks. Welcome to the studio, Jordan.
Hey, Patrick. How you doing?
I'm doing so good, man. So good. We're here sipping on some gin, some Never Sink gin. It's delicious. And it totally ties into what you do with Q Drinks, because the first product that you invented was a Q Tonic.
Exactly. And I invented it one night because I really liked my gin and the tonic was screwing it up. I thought the world needed a better tonic water.
Like, I have come up with so many ideas when I was drunk for businesses, and they evaporate when I'm hungover the next morning. But you are a true golden story of someone who held on to the idea and ran with it and made a great business out of it.
Yeah, maybe you got to drink more.
Maybe I do. Yeah, you have a lot of good things to say. I quoted actually in the introduction to this show that it's a great time for a drinker.
Yes.
Which is a lovely positive message that you don't see very often associated with drink right now.
Yeah, someone gave me a business card recently that said on the back, a no good story ever starts with, I was having a salad with a friend.
So just to give a little bit of an introduction as to what Q Drinks are, you currently have 7 products at the moment, right?
Yeah, we have a line of spectacular carbonated mixers. So a tonic water or 2 tonic waters now, a ginger beer, a ginger ale, a club soda, a cola, and a sparkling grapefruit. And kind of the concept is that you're kind of agonizing about what gin you should use or what whiskey you should use, and the mixer should have be the same quality and sophistication, and should really complement or augment the spirit rather than just being a blast of sugar that covers up all the terrific subtleties.
Yeah, and it's very funny because before I was even introduced to you, I had the Q ginger beer in my pantry. And I remember I was having gin and tonics with friends. I think maybe it was around Easter sometime. And I was thinking, we were drinking this Never Sink gin that we have here in front of us here today. But all I could taste, like you said, was the sugar.
Yeah.
And some people just think that that's as good as it gets because all you know is Schweppes and that's all you can choose for tonic water. But that was exactly what instigated you to go and lead to setting up a company. It was your disappointment in the sugar.
Yeah, that and the 6 gin and tonics I had that gave me a kind of moment of clarity. But yeah, I was at that point I lived in Fort Greene, which is, we're here in Bushwick now. It's a neighborhood in Brooklyn just a couple minutes away, and I had a bunch of friends over at my house for gin and tonics. And granted, this was I was probably 30 years old, so I could have 6 gin and tonics on a Tuesday night and be fine on a Wednesday morning. But we were drinking drink after drink, and a couple drinks in, my teeth got sticky. And I was like, that's kind of weird. Picked up the bottle of tonic water. One of my good friends was telling the same stupid story he always tells. So I picked up the bottle of tonic water and looked at the ingredients. It's been like 32 grams of high fructose corn syrup, natural and artificial flavors, sodium benzoate. I was like, that's kind of weird. I thought tonic water was this like bitter water thing. One of my other good friends, actually the girlfriend of one of my good friends, now the wife and mother of his 2 kids, she had like a stomach ache that night, so she wasn't drinking. She was drinking Sprite instead. So I was like, hey, Sarah, can I look at your Sprite for a second? She said, sure. Looked at the ingredients, 32 grams of high fructose corn syrup, natural and artificial flavors, sodium benzoate. I was like, this is crazy. Like, these are the same things. One just like green and the other one's yellow. And my friends, being good friends, just said, you know, whatever. But the kind of the idea just stuck in my head for some reason. And again, gin has a way of clarifying your thinking. And somehow the whole world was clear, but the moonlight was shining down on this Tanqueray bottle, glowing in the moonlight, you know, absolutely perfect. And looked up, and you know, it was a gorgeous summer night. And my best friends in the world were there, and everything was great. Then I looked over at the bottle of tonic water, and I was like, what a piece of crap. You know, the label's peeling off, the thing's crusty on top, the plastic is dented, like the liquid inside was obviously filled with high fructose corn syrup. And so I was like, why is it not a better tonic water? You know what? I'm going to make a better tonic water. And
you did.
Long story short, I did. Long story a bit longer. Next morning, when my head cleared, figured out what tonic water was supposed to be. It's supposed to be this quinine, which is like this bitter, bitter thing that comes from a bark, a little sugar and carbonated water. But the big soda companies had been treating the thing like a soda. So instead of having making it something that's like makes the most delicious gin and tonics, they were making something that was the cheapest and easiest thing to produce. So I said, I'm going to do it the complete opposite way. I'm going to make something that makes the best gin and tonics going. So, yeah, I ordered this bag of bark on the internet and started mixing stuff up in my kitchen. My roommate at the time was complaining about the mess and saying that we're going to get busted for running a meth lab. And I had pots and pans and, you know, to his defense, it was a huge mess. And eventually came up with like a little a syrup, a quinine syrup. And I'd make homemade gin and tonics for people. And people loved them. And that was the kind of the very beginning.
And before we start to explore and understand more about how you crafted this business, I want to go back to the very start and understand more about you, the man who created Q Drinks. Whereabouts did you grow up?
Upper West Side of New York City.
Yeah. And where'd you go to college?
Brown.
Brown?
Yeah.
What did you go to Brown for?
Public policy.
Wow.
Nothing to do with nothing.
So what led you to go and study public policy?
So the real answer is... that was the major, whatever the concentration, whatever they call it, with the fewest requirements. So,
and was that actually the reason that led you to do it? Or
yeah, like I'm interested in, like we'll get into my career at some point, but I was I'm interested in public policy, particularly as it affects cities. You know, I'm from New York City, and I like fundamentally believe in cities, and people should live in cities. It's like good for the world. It's good for people, there's some kind of big policy reasons why people suburbanized over the last 70 years. So I'm like conceptually interested in that. At the same time, if the math had been different and I had to take like 14 classes I didn't want to take, I wouldn't have majored or concentrated in it. And I just really wanted to take things I was interested in. And that was kind of the way, that's how the cards worked out. I also kind of figured out pretty early on that whatever I majored in, concentrated in, didn't really matter at all. Like, I always knew I was going to do my own thing, so it didn't really matter.
And at that stage, what kind of courses were you taking? What stuff did pique your interest? Or things that, you know, looking back, that you can reflect on that probably had some sort of an influence on what
you've done today? So the real answer, what I did is I just took the best teachers. So I would just find out, like, from the kids who were older than me, just like, hey, what was an awesome class? Like, which one did you like the best? And it tended to be teachers who were fantastic. So I took like a great class from this guy, Ted Sizer, who did a lot on education, like setting up public schools and kind of setting up a public school system. And it was just like an awesome class. And then you like design your own public school. Then I did another class on like postmodern legal theory. Like, who the hell would think that's interesting? But the teacher was really great, and it made it really interesting. So it depended. I took another great class on the history of the American Revolution. So it really depended on. I took an art class, like the history of architecture, where they like, traced the architectural movements over the last 5,000 years of humanity, which was super interesting. So kind of bounced around on things I thought were interesting that I could get really excited about.
But it, like, to me, that sounds like the dream college experience, because you kind of get to do everything that you want to do. You're constantly engaged and constantly interested.
Yeah, yeah.
It's
fantastic. And then whatever. It's also, that's the academic side. There's also the social side, which was fantastic too. But yeah, it was terrific. So that's, I loved the experience, and B, that's how I gravitated towards public policy, because it like let me take, I can kind of just self-justify anything, like, oh, that education one can be justified as education policy. Okay, that counts for your numbers. So this kind of let me do whatever I wanted to do.
And where did that take you after you finished up in Brown?
I got a fellowship to go to Sonoma County, California. with a fellowship, an economic something or another, with the Economic Development Board of Sonoma County, California, an Economic Vitality Fellow. So that was basically a one-year job without health care to work for the Economic Development Board of Sonoma County. And I don't know how much you know about Sonoma County, but it's right next to Napa. And their economic development is not the economic development that, you know, another city might have who wants to attract a big parts processing plant or like 1,000, you know, industrial jobs. They were looking for kind of high wage jobs that would throw off a lot of taxes, but have a relatively low impact on the kind of the community and the built environment. So out there, I don't know, I had a good time. My job was to come up with a program that supported micro enterprise or home based businesses. This was in the late 90s, and it was kind of just the beginning of the, I guess, the internet. And a bunch of people were like leaving San Francisco for a couple reasons. One, to, you know, start advertising agencies or some consulting groups out of their houses, or sell things like yo-yos on the internet. And it was really good for the economy because people were working. And it was also good for the communities because instead of being on the roads commuting to work, they were working out of their houses. So they were in the neighborhoods during the day, which obviously is good for the carbon impact, but also really good just to make sure that no bad people are around or that the neighborhood's safe for the kids coming home from school. So they kind of liked that. And I got hired to kind of create a support network for them.
Interesting. And then just to skip ahead to the next step in that evolution of your career and the kind of tentacles of it.
Yeah.
At some stage during this time, 9/11 happened.
Not yet. Let me tell you how actually Sonoma County relates to the drinks business, to the carbonated mixer business. So I was when I got out there, the county of Sonoma put me up at like an employee's of the county's house. You know, I can rented a room or something. And I had left all my friends, New York City, Brown, I had an awesome time, and I kind of left my life and moved out to San Francisco, to Sonoma, and, you know, moved into this kind of suburban family's house, and they were really, really nice, but this was not what I was looking to do with my time. So I found the ad in the paper and moved into this guy's kind of guest house, guest cabin, up in the hills above Calistoga, and he was a terrific, he was a, kind of a ne'er-do-well slash terrific guy. He was had a really, really good time. He had this house with 200-foot redwood trees. My little house had no indoor shower, but it was overlooking a gorgeous stream with an outdoor shower. And he would have big parties with all these folk musician friends coming on over all the time. And it was just a good time. He, among other things, made his own wine. So he knew a guy up in Cloverdale, which is northern Sonoma County, where it's like almost like this old Italian guy. I think the guy died or something or moved somewhere, and there's this like field of grapes that no one was really using. And Sean had some like permission to pick the grapes. And what he would do is he would like organize a gang, and we'd like cut the grapes and crush them and barrel them, and then let it sit for a year, and then bottle them. And basically, he did that in order to drink whatever free or whatever it was. He would have go basically through a barrel of wine every year by himself. And he and his friends, you know, make 6 barrels or something. With about 12 or 14 cases, he would give them to some fancy restaurant in Marin, and he would do that in exchange for a gift certificate. And he'd go and have dinner at the place, and he'd look at the wine list, look for his label, which he called Buffalo Blood, and he would look at it and said, you know, what's this Buffalo Blood? I've never heard of that. And the waitress would say, well, it's like beyond biodynamic. It's like wild wine. So they pick it. They don't even put finishing yeast on it. They basically just put it in a barrel and then put it in a bottle. And when it's good, it's phenomenal. When it's bad, it's really, really bad, and you will know it immediately. And we'll replace it. So when I had this idea for the tonic water, I was like, wow, if that Yahoo can make great wine, I can make a great tonic water. So it was like that confidence is what I guess what did it for me.
And do you think it kind of simplified the production process? For someone to look on the outset to get an idea like you had to create tonic, did it make it seem much more approachable by seeing what
you had? I guess so. Like, I guess it broke it up into steps. Like, oh, you just cut the grapes, then you crush them, then you barrel them. Okay, you do those three things. How do you do it? Oh, you need a big thing to put the grapes in. So I guess it did that. I think it was more just a confidence thing.
Yeah.
Like if that guy, like, I guess one of the things you learn when you grow up is that, like, no one's the expert, right? And I learned that at college, but also when that guy was making this good grapes, wine, it wasn't like he knew what he was doing either. So then I had the confidence with a tonic water. So it was the breaking into pieces, but I think more than anything, it was the confidence.
Okay, and then to touch on that, then in the next part.
Oh, so get into 9/11. So actually, skipping a couple of years in San Francisco, this was the go-go days of the first go-go days of the internet, and someone offered me way too much money to do some online marketing, I think for Disney, and I was in charge of a couple people and a lot of money, and I was like, "Well, you're going to pay me all that, and you don't know what you're doing either? Sure, I'll do that." So I did that for a couple of years, and then a friend was starting a company, which was going to be the next Microsoft. So I joined him, and that was doing well until...
What was that company called?
It's called eQuil. And then I guess it was the 2000 recession hit, and instead of being... I guess 2001. Yeah, because it was 2001. Instead of being the next for Microsoft, we got bought out for cents on the dollar, Microsoft. And so I was getting paid all this money from everybody. I didn't really have that much time to spend it or the inclination to spend it. So I then had some time. So I spent a couple months traveling through Europe and came back and visited my parents on the Upper West Side on September 9th, 2001. And I was obviously here on September 11th and the world blew up. And my flight on the 13th was canceled, and on the 20th, I didn't feel comfortable flying, but on the 27th, by the time my flight actually did go out, I decided that I was going to move back to New York and help. I just really wanted to help rebuild New York City. So I packed my stuff up. I got back to New York right before Thanksgiving, and by the first week of December, I was working for a thing called the Alliance for Downtown New York, which manages the Business Improvement District for Lower Manhattan. And I eventually had a really awesome job, but at the very beginning, my job was overseeing power washers who were cleaning the debris off the retail storefronts in the area right around the former World Trade Center site. And I don't know if anybody remember, but it was a little depressing being down there. Like literally 2 or 3 months later, there was still just like debris and just like crap on all everywhere that had like fallen off the World Trade Center. I was in charge of getting some power washers. So I signed up, I don't know, 2 or 3 power washers, companies who would like clean everything. And my secret trick management technique was these guys would work at night because they just couldn't do it during the day. So I would go out to the bar at night, and then at 1 o'clock in the morning, as I was going home, I would stop off down at the site that they were working at and
catch them all off guard.
Yeah, and then they're like, "Holy shit, who is this guy showing up?" And
he's
on the ball, and he's always happy. And so I'd show up, and anyway, they did the job really well, really quickly. And then I don't know, I was there for about 2 or 3 years, and it was awesome. My job for the last 2 years was coming up with ideas and getting them funded and implemented that would revitalize the area. And I did a lot with telecom and a lot with technology. And it was awesome, or it started off being awesome. At the beginning, there was just a ton of money flowing. People, if it was a good idea, people said, "Yeah, go do it." Eventually got very political. And it was during this time when I was at the Alliance for Downtown New York, I had the idea for the tonic water.
That evening in Brooklyn happened.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, before we get into those next stages and the evolution of Q Drinks, we're going to go to a quick break, and then we can come back and hear it all.
Great.
This program is brought to you by Chefs Collaborative, a national nonprofit network with a mission to inspire, educate, and celebrate chefs and food professionals building a better food system. Chefs Collaborative members work to make sustainable practices second nature for every chef in the United States. Chefs Collaborative was founded in 1993 by visionary chefs including Rick Bayless and Alice Waters, who acknowledged the influential role of food professionals on our food choices, our collective personal health, the vitality of cultures, and the integrity of the global environment. Chefs Collaborative believes that the greater culinary community can be a catalyst for positive change by expanding the market for good food and helping to preserve local farming and fishing communities. Change menus, change lives. Learn more about Chefs Collaborative at chefscollaborative.org.
Hi, I'm Sam Benrubi, host of The Grape Nation on Heritage Radio Network. Tune in every Wednesday at 6 p.m. to hear some of the best people in wine tell you about what's going on in the world of wine. Support my show and all of Heritage Radio Network's programming. Go to heritageradionetwork.org and click on the beating heart to donate.
Right. Welcome back to Why Food. I'm here with Jordan Silbert, and we are discussing his evolution and career path before he led into Q Drinks. So before we went to a break, we were just talking about your lifestyle, where it took you, and just up until that point, you had been working for the... Just want to get the correct name, the Alliance for Downtown New York.
Yeah, or Downtown Alliance.
Downtown Alliance for New York. And then during that time, you decided that you want to go to Yale Business School. What was the interest in deciding to make that step?
So, as I said, the job was awesome for the first couple of years. Eventually, it got really political. And kind of the thing that really broke the camel's back is I had this idea that, not to get too geeky, but it was going to be kind of a wireless redundancy system for Lower Manhattan. It was going to have lasers on the top of tall buildings in Lower Manhattan and basically enable anybody or 95% of the employers with 50 or more employees to have a little thing in their window that they could connect to the mesh network that would enable them to keep their data and voice connection if something happened in the streets again. And in so doing, position the area as the place for businesses that want to stay in business. And great, great, great. The governor announced it. I thought it was going to be awesome. It was the first one in the world. And then Verizon's lobbyists kind of put the kibosh on it. And that got me pretty frustrated because I'd been working for 2 years on it. And I just kind of wanted to have more control over the funding sources. So I... Because, go back to my experience at Brown. Like, I wanted to do what I wanted to do. I wanted to be in a position where I could have more control. And so I thought if I had business school, I could figure out how people can give me the money to do stuff rather than run it through the government or some other nonprofit. And I went back to Yale's business school.
And was the initial kind of step of thinking about, you know, how people can give you the funding, was it to work within the lines of public policy at that time?
I thought I would give me flexibility to do what I want, ultimately, you know.
And how was that experience at Yale Business School?
So I had a fantastic time, and I'm doing pretty well now. But my first year at business school was really challenging. There was all these, like, set classes, and they were so, like, academic and, like, all this homework, which was, seemed so unreal worldy. And I kind of went back to business school to kind of give me the tools to be able to do what I wanted to do better. Whether it be to get people to give me money to be able to do something or actually do the thing better. And we were doing this, like, all these, like, esoteric, totally boring homework assignments. So I had a great summer in between my 2 years of business school. I went down to Panama and worked with a guy who was revitalizing the colonial old quarter of Panama City. And that was fun. And I came back and I was like, you know what? I'm not doing that stupid stuff anymore. I want to do stuff that I want to do. Like, there's so many awesome things out there. I'm not doing, like, math homework anymore. So one of my professors had started Honest Tea, a guy named Barry Nailboff, who's just, like, a wonderful guy. And I came back and talked to him, and I said, hey, I had this idea for a tonic water company. I had this syrup that people love. I think I want to give this a shot. Can I just, like, do an independent study with you for a year? And Barry is, like, one of the smartest people on the planet, as far as I can tell. But not only really smart, but also really practical. He said, you know, sure, I'd be happy to do that with you. However, you'll have one assignment. I do not need 100-page paper on whatever market study. I need one thing. I need the last day of school, do you put a bottle on my desk? It's got to taste good. Because he had started on his tea, and tea is easier than tonic water not to get super technical, but the carbonation in tonic water is actually a little more complicated, and it just makes it harder to produce. You can make tea in your kitchen, literally, whereas tonic water, you can just not get the carbonation levels outside of an industrial facility. So neither he nor I knew that at the time, but he was thinking that when they started Honest Tea, he sold in some ungodly amount of tonic water to Whole Whole Foods, and they then had a lot of trouble making it. So he said, okay, you start by trying to figure out how to make the goddamn thing. So I spent that year calling glass bottle companies, actual production facilities, and eventually I got one production facility up in Worcester, Massachusetts, who made the mistake of picking up the phone once. And basically I figured out within 3 seconds of talking to the guy that he wasn't going to pick up the phone again. So I basically said, can I come up and ask you a question? So I drove up to Worcester, and every time I would have a question, I would just like show up in Worcester and ask him a question. So I spent a year doing that, and by the end, I had a prototype that was pretty good. And that's what I sold into Gramercy Tavern, who was our first customer. Jim Meehan, who later went on to start PDT, he was our first customer. Then Sasha from Milk and Honey was our second. Sasha, I give him, I guess Sasha is the first customer, or was the first customer, because he's the first one who paid me. He paid me cash out of the register. I did my first delivery at 2:30 in the morning after close, and he paid me cash out of the register.
It's an amazing start to a story, because a lot of the people that we've had on the show over time, they've talked about the grinding out phase of starting it, and then, you know, the evolution and how it really took pace and took it got its own identity.
Yeah.
Whereas your start is special because you went to Gramercy Tavern, you went to Milk and Honey at a time when cocktail mixology was really starting to take shape, and Milk and Honey was one of the bars that was the blueprint for cocktail bars in the world.
I think it was the.
Or the, yeah, quite possibly. And then you went to Blue Hillstone Barn, so you started going towards fine dining.
Yep.
And then the next step was when Plymouth Gin got in touch, which led to a New York Times article, which exposed you to the whole world.
Exactly.
And that was all in the space of how much time?
3 months, 4 months?
Yeah. So looking back, and we're going to, you know, fill in the blanks in between that, a lot of people will discuss the difficulties or reflecting on things that they would have changed. For you, what was the most difficult stage in the business over the past 12 years?
Huh. I honestly don't spend that much time thinking about what was difficult. I'm always tend to think about what's difficult right now.
Or times that kind of brought the most struggle and strife, I suppose.
So a lot of it has just been patience. A lot of what we've done has been not that difficult. It's just been grinding it out day in, day out. From day one, every step away from the customer has been incrementally more difficult. So from day one, I had customers who, as first as soon as I showed them a better tonic water, like, oh yeah, I want a better tonic water. Can you make me a ginger ale? Can you make me a ginger beer? So the customers got it. It was every step away from that customer, whether it be the distributor, whether it be the retailer, whether it be the production facility. And I needed to figure all those things out. Some of them I could just kind of figure out on my own, but other ones were relationship-based, and that I just didn't have the relationships. I didn't know Joey who knew Bobby. And so I had to do a lot of cold calls. And that, you know, when you say that, oh, you know, it's great that we signed on Gramercy Tavern, Blue Hill at Stone Barn, and Milk and Honey as our first customers. Like, it is awesome. But it's also, in retrospect, the only way it would have happened. You know, I wasn't going to just, like, call up, you know, we're now at Kroger, we're now at Target, we're now at Safeway Albertsons. We're at some of the largest retailers in the world, and we're sold on Carnival Cruise Lines. Like, we're at a lot of places. None of those guys would have picked up the phone if I had called them, you know, 12 years ago. But Jim and Sasha, they actually are looking for better stuff, or were looking for better stuff. And Dan Barber was looking for a better tonic water. He wasn't actively seeking it, but when I showed up and I showed, hey, I got a better tonic water, he's like, oh, I'll try that. So that was the way it worked. So it's all those other steps were really difficult that took relationships. And you can eventually get those relationships, but you kind of have to prove yourself to know somebody who knows somebody.
Yeah, I suppose that's a fair point. But one of the interesting things about your business and about your approach to the business is that we all know soda gets a bad rep. It's one of those products that the customer is aware that it's not a good product for them, but they don't know what it is per se. They know that there's high fructose corn syrup because that's something that's talked about a lot. But apart from that, it's something that happens in a factory and it's very much closed off. What separates your product from the generic soda that we see in stores?
So we use, I guess there's three main differences. We use like fantastic ingredients, real ingredients from real trees and real plants.
And what would be used then by those companies as a substitute?
Artificial flavors or synthetic flavors.
That are created in a lab.
In lab, yeah.
Yeah.
Or even when they do use real stuff, they use cheap real stuff. Mm. We're at Roberta's here. Like, there's a lot of reasons their pizza's pretty good. But part of it is they use great cheese. They use great bread, and they use great tomato sauce. And that is expensive. It's $15 for a small pizza here. But part of that is because the ingredients cost a lot. So we choose ingredients regardless of cost or complexity. And I'll give you an example. In our ginger ale, we use rose oil. You know, ginger ale was our second flavor, and at the time, I don't know. When I look back and like, what were the inflection points for the company and what were some of the good decisions and bad decisions I made, the ginger ale was one of the great ones. That we had, you know, literally Jim Meehan was asking me for a ginger ale like the second day I saw, second day after I met him. And he had brought the tonic water into Gramercy Tavern. And he said, it should be pretty easy. And in retrospect, now I know it would have been easy just to buy an off-the-shelf flavor, put it in, put a cue on it, and sell him a case. But what I did was I did the ginger ale, and I agonized over it. And I did like 26 different recipes, and I made it myself. And what that did was give us kind of permission to have all these other flavors. But one of the secrets of the ginger ale is we put rose oil in our ginger ale. When I started with kind of real ginger, like I did with tonic water, and then organic agave is the way we sweeten most of our flavors. I was like, I'll try that. But there was something missing. There was like a depth and complexity that wasn't there. So I was agonizing. Finally, I knew a friend of a friend like works in the perfume industry, and I was like asking him, like, you know, what, any ideas? This is what I'm up against. Like, this is what my ginger tastes like. It's just, I don't know what's wrong with it. He said, have you tried rose oil? I was like, no, I haven't. So I tried a little rose oil, and it tasted great. Just like added a fullness to it. And it's not like a floral, too floral, but just had a fullness to it. Turns out rose oil costs $1,000 an ounce. The good news, we don't put an ounce of rose oil in our ginger ale, but we put some in it. And a big soda company in a million years would not do that. So we use better ingredients. That's the first thing that makes us different. The next thing we do is we use a lot less sugar, and we use fancy sugar. We use organic agave or organic cane sugar, but we use a lot less of it. I don't know, the line that we started that you mentioned earlier, like it's a fantastic time to be a drinker. It is a fantastic time to be a drinker. And sugar is bad for you as a drinker for a lot of reasons. You know, sugar is not good for you, probably not good for the planet. It probably causes diabetes, probably might even cause cancer. Like, it's just not good. Set aside all that and just think about it from the drinker's perspective. There are so many awesome spirits out there. You know, this gin we're drinking right now is terrific. There are hundreds of great gins, both made by little guys and the big guys. The big guys make good stuff, by and large. However, if you use a mixer with too much sugar, you can't taste all those subtleties. You know, the master distiller for all of these spirits has agonized over what grain to use, what shape the still should be, how many times to fire it through the still, what botanicals to put in, how to age it, whatever they're agonized over, they've agonized to death over this thing. And if you put a mixer in with too much sugar, you can't taste any of that. You know, think about when you're starting to drink and you drink wine coolers or, you know, Everclear with Tang or whatever it is. You're dumping a ton of sugar on that because you don't want to taste the spirit. But if you actually do want to taste the spirit, you need a mixer with a lot less sugar. So our stuff has a lot less sugar. So, again, you can taste the subtleties in a good spirit. And then the third thing is we have a lot of carbonation. So we have a custom glass bottle, which is thicker, that enables us to, you know, put more carbonation in, and then we treat carbonation like an ingredient. So each of our flavors has a different carbonation level depending on what tastes best in the drink. So those are the three things that makes us different. So we use fantastic ingredients, and we pay more for them. Two, we use a lot less sugar, and three, you have a lot more carbonation.
Definitely stands up to the typical stuff and the mainstream stuff. And it's beautiful products as well, that the way that it's shaped and the glass in it.
Yeah.
Like I said, I have it at home. We use it for gin and ginger beer, and it's great for a gin mule. I think it's a great product. I really, really enjoy it. Do you think that it's that there's going to be a market for these kind of artisanal sodas going forward? Have you seen that there's been a development in it in the recent future?
So as mixers, certainly. Like, you look at all the numbers and you see premium spirits. You know, premium spirits are now, you know, basically absolute vodka and above for two-thirds of the market for spirits these days. Like, that's where all the growth has been over the last decade and a half. And it just doesn't make sense to mix a good spirit with a crappy mixer.
We're just going to go to another quick break here, and then we're going to come back and touch on the last topic. Welcome back to Why Food. I'm here with Jordan Silbert, and we are continuing on the story of the great evolution of Q drinks. So can we talk a little bit more as to what you have right now? We talked about the tonic was the initial drink, and then it expanded into the ginger ale. Was it a quick expansion from there on to move into the five other products that you carry right now?
So, by the way, it took me 4 years to get to the ginger ale.
Right, okay.
So after that, it's been basically a flavor a year. So the two that I'm most excited about, actually the one I'm most excited about right now, is our sparkling grapefruit, which is phenomenal in Palomas, which is with tequila, or my wife is drinking it with mezcal right now. And it's just like super easy, but also incredibly refreshing, complex, just like a delicious summer drink. So it's this sparkling grapefruit with basically either tequila or mezcal and a squeeze of lime. And if you really want to get fancy, you can put a salt rim on it. So that is pretty awesome. Then the other one, we just came out with a new tonic water. It's purpose-built for London dry gins. So what London dry gin is, you know, Tanqueray or Beefeater, which is like a big junipery gin. And compared to our original tonic water, the new Q Indian tonic has more bitter, more quinine, a little more sugar, and the same amount of carbonation. So it kind of stands up to the big gins a lot better, and it's kind of more like the quintessential gin and tonic, as opposed to our first tonic, which is designed for things like this never to sink gin, which have a little more subtlety going, because the original tonic is so dry. It's like, you know, 60% less sugar than Schweppes. So it's so dry that you can really taste all those crazy subtleties. Whereas with a kind of a traditional gin, with a real, you know, regular British gin and tonic, a proper British gin and tonic, I think you need kind of a bigger tonic water. And that's what we just came out with.
Right. And are all these things kind of in response to what the customers are requesting, or are these now ideas that are happening back of house and kind of ideas where
mostly just like my mouth, like what I'm excited about drinking,
yeah,
is the real answer.
Very interesting. And I know you talked at the start about how you wanted to have it shaped in glasses. Now you're obviously expanding and you're moving into cans and things like that. Has it been difficult to go from focusing with people who really are educated at home in terms of people who want to make quality drinks at home and people who are in bars like mixologists? Has it been difficult to make that switch into the mainstream, just the public audience that may have an interest in?
So the answer is no. Like, I think that's the difference between us and like a lot of craft spirit companies. Like, everybody drinks gin and tonic. Everybody drinks Moscow Mules. Everybody drinks vodka sodas. Everybody drinks Jack and Gingers. And then a lot of them are buying good spirits already. Now they have a good mixer to mix with it. And it's pretty darn easy. You put a little spirit in, you put some mixer in. You know, this isn't some like artisanal bitter or some like cacao liqueur. This is tonic water, a ginger beer, a ginger ale. People know how to use it. And in terms of the interest, you know, all these people, it's not just mixologists in Brooklyn who are buying better gins or better vodkas or better rums or better whiskeys. And those people, you know, it's not like I'm a genius marketer. Those people wanted to buy better mixers. They just didn't have the option of doing that. So it's been pretty seamless. And it's actually us, the market was there before we were there. And we've been kind of sucked into it, I think.
I really enjoy your faith and your confidence in your product, the way everything is labeled as spectacular.
Yes.
I think that definitely attracts people to it. I'm just looking at the products here online, and they're obviously gorgeous, but you have every right to feel confident behind it and to label them as spectacular. Now, generally, we finish out each show because along the lines, usually it's in food. And I ask the question, what has the food industry given you? This is a little bit different, but in the soda industry, you have access to the food and drink industry. What has it given you since you've gone into it from comparison to your past careers?
So I've had a fantastic time. Like, I get to go to literally the best restaurants on the planet because they're the ones who are buying our stuff. And I get to say thank you, but I also just get to have a dinner or a drink there. And that's pretty darn fun. So I've been to most of the major cities in America with this job. And I've eaten and drank at some of the best places literally on the planet. So that's one thing. The other thing is I've made stuff. And my mother was a potter. So growing up, and she used to make bowls and plates and things like that. And she stopped when she got pregnant with me because of all the chemicals. But growing up, the most valuable things in my house, the thing, you know, I was a rambunctious kid and I break everything. And the one thing I was not allowed to break, or else there'd be, you know, big trouble, was the stuff that she had made, the cups and the bowls and the plates that we still eat off of when we go to her house. That was what was valuable, not the TV, not my great-great-grandmother's whatever glass vase or whatever it was. It was the stuff that my mother made. And so that's what the food industry has kind of given me. It's the opportunity to make something that I'm really, really proud of. And that, you know, there's a lot of long nights and a lot of frustrating mornings. And whenever that happens, I look over at a bottle of the stuff we made. And it's like, wow, I made that. That would not exist in the world had I not had this crazy idea and then grinded away for the last 10 years. And that's incredibly rewarding. And that's just kind of what I feel really appreciative for the industry. It kind of enabled me to make something.
Fantastic. And after hearing the story, if people want to go out and buy your product, where can they find it in the most accessible of means?
So we have a tracker on our website, Q Drinks, Q the letter, drinks, like the plural of drinks, qdrinks.com. Just go to About Us. There's a big map where you can plug in your zip code and tell you where to go. But most of the leading retailers in the country have us now, from Whole Foods to Kroger to Target to Albertsons to Safeway. And then we're at, you know, thousands of better bars and restaurants around the country as well.
Super. Well, thank you very much for coming on the show today.
And I should say Amazon. Amazon sells a lot of our stuff as well.
That's a very good one. It's available online. Got it shipped to your door.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for coming on the show today. It's been a wonderful story, and I'm so glad you've shared it here with me and our listeners.
Cheers.
And thanks very much to Megan as well for orchestrating all this today. I want to say a massive thank you as well to Heritage Radio for putting such a wonderful platform out for conversation for so many various topics within the world of food and drink and wine. If you want to get into more shows on the station, you can visit heritageradionetwork.org. And please donate to the station. It's funded by the listeners. So if you want to click the beating heart in the top right corner, you can donate some money towards what we're trying to provide here. If you enjoyed today's show, please rate and subscribe to the show. That small action has a huge reaction for the show's popularity. I also want to say a massive thank you to you for listening to today's show. If you ever want to get in touch with me, please email me at whyfood@heritageradionetwork.org, or you can also follow me on Instagram at whyfoodpodcast, where you can see the most recent video that I put up with Skepta, a bottle of Never Sink Gin, and a Q ginger beer, which was really, really good. Until next week, thank you very much, guys. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.